You cut your hair.
I did, yes. I cut it while I was on a cruise in December.
Very nice.
Because we had the baby coming, and my wife said that I looked like a dirty hippie. And I should stop that. So
yeah.
I cut off all my hair on a cruise ship.
Wow. Did
the
you do
cruise
yourself?
Ship bar? No. I went to the salon.
Very nice. I can't imagine how overpriced that was.
I actually don't even know. I do remember the lady who cut it was like very surprised, just because I don't think people normally drastically change their appearance while on vacation.
Yeah. It's probably just like, you know, make me look fancy for dinner and not please cut off, you know, 10 inches of hair. Are you working on anything fun?
Not really. Like, you know, I'm on parental leave for the next 4.5 months.
Nice. That's a decent leave.
Yeah. We both took 6 months off.
That's incredible.
Because the Canadian government gives you 52 weeks to split between the two parents however you want.
Nice.
At 55% of your pay up till a certain cap. And then Shopify tops us off to 85% of our salary for almost all of it. I think like 30 something weeks. I don't remember the exact amount.
That's awesome.
It's actually pretty normal outside of America is the sad thing.
Yeah.
At least the government, like the government assisted portion of it, maybe not so much the company like topping that off a significant amount, but
yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, so, you know, I've been working on diesel a decent bit between feeding the baby. Most recently, we added MySQL support.
Very cool. Was there a lot of like requests for SQL support, or was that
for
something
MySQL?
You wanted to do? Yeah.
So originally we were only ever going to support Postgres because just like use Postgres.
Yeah.
We eventually added SQLite support because Rust is a systems language and an embedded database makes a lot of sense as a use case for an ORM in a systems language. And since somebody had a valid use case that was something other than I prefer this database or my company makes me use this database. I was very like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And the third or fourth time it came up, we added SQLite support, which took a while because it's a lot harder to go, like MySQL support required almost no code other than the code that was just like for MySQL. It didn't require changing the rest of the library too much.
Yeah.
Adding SQLite support required changing the rest of the library quite a bit because we went from supporting one to supporting greater than one, which is always the hardest.
Yeah.
And then SQLite was also interesting because it enabled us to have really interesting use cases on Android and iOS.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to like, have you used Rails much for like database migrations?
Nope.
I'm assuming you've used, I don't remember the name of the class, but whatever the heck you used to manage SQLite database schemas on Android.
SQLite Helper.
Yeah, is it the one where you implement the like migrate, or is it called up or migrate, but basically it gives you the current version and the target version, and then it's like, figure it out yourself.
Yep.
So one of the things that Rails does is you generate these migrations through a command line tool, and they're versioned just with timestamps. And then there's a CLI command that you just run, and it figures out, it basically just diffs all of the migrations between.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's not necessarily always a straight roll forward because it's possible for like there to be, you know, migration 1, 2, 3, and 4 and you've run 1 and 3 locally, but you never ran 2 because branches.
Right.
And so it'll then run 2 followed by 4. And the assumption being that it's more likely, and that part of why we use timestamps for the versions in Rails is just because the theory that it's more likely that your migrations are just going to be like unrelated from different branches than they are to actually conflict with each other. And so Diesel has a similar migration infrastructure, but then once we added SQLite support, and once people started using it for mobile, it was like, oh, hey, you don't always have control over the file system.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily always rely on, like, run this function, and then it goes and looks in this directory for these files and does all this stuff. So we added, a thing that embeds all of your migrations in the actual binary so that we have a single dylib that you can load from Java and then have all of that.
That's awesome.
Anyway, so then MySQL was always just sort of a thing. That was like the only real use case for it was I don't want to use Postgres because either I have opinions about databases that Sean disagrees with or my company makes me or we have a legacy schema.
Yeah.
I know those were too compelling, but just enough people asked that I eventually caved.
Yeah.
So we had MySQL support in this most recent release.
That's very cool. Is it going to be easier now in the future to add other I don't know any other database managers, but like, would it be easier now to hypothetically add infinite amount?
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah, MySQL. So there was actually, I lied when I said no changes were required to the library. There was one change, which was that I assumed that everything that transmitted over the network used network endian.
Mm-hmm.
MySQL does not. It uses little endian.
Got it.
So I changed that so that the back end can say I transmit integers as little or big endian.
Yeah.
That was the only library level change that was required, though. Everything else was just like, you know, we have this interface, provide an implementation of that interface for MySQL. It's very JDBC like, mm-hmm. other than just being much more type safe.
Very cool.
And then the most recent hell from this week was turning on AppVar for the repo, which I've been meaning to do just forever.
I have no idea what that is either.
That is a Windows CI system.
Ah, got it.
It got to the point where I was getting, eventually somebody helped me figure out that I was getting the Windows equivalent of a segmentation fault.
Okay.
Because it was really funky because my program was just exiting with error test failed, which is always the last output of the test binary when a unit test fails.
Yeah.
But normally it says which unit test failed, but it wasn't telling me that.
Interesting.
But it was at least saying error test failed, so it wasn't just immediately aborting the process.
Yeah.
And it had a negative exit code, which seemed really weird. And eventually somebody helped me figure out that, like, if you change that to an unsigned integer and then convert that to hex, it was C000005, which is an access error code in Windows.
Got it.
But that still didn't help at all. So I spent about 10 hours remote desktopping in to a AppVar node, like just trying random stuff. And then every hour having it terminate my session and having to restart everything from scratch.
That's
and
brutal.
I found that finally I found that MySQL is writing a 4 to freed memory.
That'll do it.
And that was the problem.
But hey, you learned.
I learned.
Yeah.
I learned that the only thing worse than MySQL the database is MySQL the C API. Which I already knew, but this just reinforced that.
Yep. That's really funny.
How about you? How's Android?
Android's good. Same old, same old. I'm still writing in Kotlin, which is really nice.
Nice.
But I was going to ask some more questions about open source, since Mike Burns, who's a developer here at Thoughtbot, just attended a conference for other open source contributors. And I guess after the conference had ended, it was here in San Francisco, he came in to lunch. And we had a bunch of really interesting conversations about the kind of things they all talked about, what the big problems are.
Wait. Did Mike Burns move to San Francisco?
No. He was just in town for this conference.
Okay.
And so it was really interesting to hear about what kind of all these major open source contributors, what their pain points were, what they all could agree on was terrible. The conference, it seemed like, was also organized kind of as like an open source repo. Everything was documented in a repository. I guess everyone opened issues, and then that's how sessions were picked based on like popularity, which of that was very meta of them.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I've open sourced the library since I've been here, and I'm now very deep in the just managing it kind of phase of its life and getting feature requests. And it's not something that I work on every day by any stretch. And it's like how to politely let people know, like, I'm really sorry that your manager doesn't want to let you use this one class, but like, I'm not going to change my whole library because of it.
Right.
I had someone open an issue because the pseudocode that we use in the README was not complete. It wasn't code, which I thought was a safe expectation. But I'm guessing someone went to copy and paste it, and they were like, "This, all the syntax is wrong. Like, fix it now." It's like, okay.
I don't know. I mean, there is benefit, not necessarily from like copy pasteability, but there is benefit from fully syntactically valid and executable examples, simply just because you can run those as part of your unit tests.
Yep.
And ensuring that your examples in the README are still valid is a useful thing.
No, but for sure.
Also, that person probably shouldn't be copy-pasting.
Yeah, there's also an entire sample app with sample unit tests in addition to the library tests. So I was kind of like, it just like look a little deeper and it's all right there.
Right.
But I understand.
I mean, at least on your first statement, though, props for, at the very least, being at the point of just because this doesn't work for your exact feature request doesn't mean that your feature request is valid.
Yeah.
Or necessary.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the hardest part about open source is saying no.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And finding a reason to other than I don't want to. Because I think a lot of open source starts from like, I have a problem. Let me see if I can solve it and hopefully help other people. So you do it and you solve your problem. And then 6 months goes by and you're like, oh my God, I don't care about this problem anymore. But there's this thing out in the wild.
Right.
So,
I mean, I think usually a good way to resolve that is just to ask them to clarify and explore further.
Yep.
Which oftentimes just has the side effect of like making them go away, which is kind of also fine sometimes.
Yeah.
But like, it's hard to express, and it, like, saying it bluntly can kind of come off as rude,
right.
But ultimately, if somebody opens a pull request to a library, it's their job to convince you that their problem is worth solving.
Absolutely.
And also that their solution is the best solution to that problem.
Yep.
And I think that if somebody opens a pull request that doesn't do both of those things, asking, you know, not necessarily phrasing it in the way I just did, but asking, like, hey, so I'm not sure I fully understand the use case this is trying to solve. Can you better demonstrate to me, like, why this problem exists in a more general context?
Yeah.
Do you think this affects other users, or is it a very niche thing? Have you explored other alternative solutions? Why is this solution the best?
Yep. I think that all works very well in the ideal. I think the reality ends up being a lot more people opening issues that are like half questioned, like they haven't really looked through the library to see if that library answers it, you know, or if it's not, there isn't a method named exactly what they think it is. It's like, does this library do this? It's like, it's open sourced. You can see it, but also like understanding that like that's not, you know,
that's always going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest thing you can do there is just provide a channel that isn't GitHub issues.
Yep.
Because the big thing with GitHub issues as the primary help channel is that oftentimes you're the only one who's watching that.
Yep.
So having an official IRC room or Gitter room where you are active in answering them.
Yeah.
Because just ultimately that's part of open source, right?
Right.
If people have questions, they're going to need answers. And it's also valuable feedback, right?
Yeah.
If the method wasn't named exactly what they thought it was supposed to be. And a lot of people think it's supposed to be named something else.
Yep.
But, you know, eventually, like one of the things with Diesel that's been pretty heartening lately is, like, I'll wake up in the morning, I'll check the Gitter room, and few people ask questions, and somebody else already answered all of them for me. Perfect.
Amazing.
And that, you know, that takes time, but, like, that happens. But that's more likely to happen when the forum isn't GitHub issues.
Right.
And then, depending on the project, like, with Rails, just because it's so pervasive that it just needs to stop, I will always, no matter what, even if it's a trivial question to answer, I will always immediately close the issue with, this is not the right place to ask for help. Here are the right places to ask for help.
Yeah.
With Diesel, I'm a little bit more lenient. I'll be like, depending on how, if the question is something that like takes a while to answer or not, I'll either close it and say something similar, or I'll be like, here's the answer to your question. But also in the future, you should ask here, where people who aren't me are more likely to also help answer these questions.
Yeah. I do think there's definitely, because of the way GitHub issues are structured, I think it doesn't encourage other people who might have the answer to answer them. It definitely seems like I'm asking you, the author, contributor, or writer, a question, and you're the only one who I want to hear from. But I think that something happens when libraries get bigger that other people start answering or adding on to the question that doesn't happen on smaller scale libraries. And I wonder if like it's the kind of thing where if issues were structured differently, or if, you know, GitHub provided a different tool, which I think at some point that kind of gets out of scope, but some other way
GitHub provided Stack Overflow.
Right, exactly. It was some other like kind of hybrid way for people to have that conversation and to feel encouraged to participate would be most excellent.
I do agree that separating them would help, because I think part of the reason that people that you find fewer not you people responding to the issues that are question format is it's hard to separate questions from legit bug reports.
Right.
And the people who are interested in answering questions aren't necessarily interested in helping fix bugs.
Yep.
But then also to find out when new questions are asked, right, you have to watch the repo. And if you're watching the repo, though, then you're also going to get notified for pull requests and bug reports, which if you're a person who's only interested in answering questions, might not be a thing to you.
Yeah.
Hi, not GitHub friends. Hi, Katrina. Please fix.
Speaking of GitHub, did you notice that they changed the bar at the top to be black?
Oh, and especially all of my friends who have GitHub Enterprise accounts were freaking out about it, because that's what GitHub Enterprise has always been black.
Yep.
So that you know if you're on your Enterprise GitHub or on proper GitHub, and now
they have no idea.
Well, there's an option to change the Enterprise GitHub color to white.
Ooh.
So I think everybody I know is just
backwards.
I just wish GitHub had like had a blog post when they did that was just like, you've not been opted into a beta.
Yeah.
This is just a design change. It's fine. And then everybody could have stopped freaking out.
Yeah, everything is going to be okay. One of the designers here in the SF office made a Chrome extension making it white again.
I just love how much people freaked out about it because it just happened and nobody said anything.
Yeah.
And like people had a visceral reaction to it.
Oh, people
not bad,
change.
But just like nobody knew what was going on. And everybody assumed that the color changing meant something was going on.
And then Stack Overflow also updated their like header banner to now like be persistent while you scroll. So web is just losing it. Everything is changing.
Yeah. I mean, that always happens.
Yeah.
also on mobile.
Not as fast on mobile.
Okay, you know, speaking of mobile and web.
Yes.
So one of these trends that's been really irking me and that, like, Google seems to be encouraging.
Uh-huh.
Because they keep on making WebView better.
Yes.
Which is annoying because it means that people are using ActionOpen less.
Yes.
Right? And it's just they have a link and they open it in a WebView.
Yep.
And then Twitter in particular and Reddit are the two apps in particular that really grind my gears because they're the ones that I most want to multitask with.
Twitter, you can, there's a setting in the Twitter app to open the link.
Is there a setting now?
Or at least there was. There is a setting to open links not in the app and in Chrome.
Because I remember they made this change like a year or two ago, and I remember complaining.
Yeah, there's a setting.
I will look for it later. I'm not going to look for it right now.
But yeah, I used to do that. That's really helpful for me, at least on Twitter. It was like, okay, I want to read this, but I'm in the middle. I want to get through the rest of the feed first. And so I would just, keep hitting links, and that's perfect.
Right, I click the link and then I click the menu and then open in Chrome. But then it's also annoying because oftentimes the link to a URL that I have a native app for.
Right. And then
open it in the native app.
Yep.
Although granted, actually, if it's something that I want to have multiple tabs open and it's not an app that has like a stack type deal for it, then I have the same multitasking problem. But aside from that, everybody who uses WebViews for anything that involves user-generated links should just seriously needs an always use ActionOpen setting.
I agree. I totally agree. I think there are cases for native WebViews. At Venmo, we used WebViews for things that we wanted to be able to change very regularly and not have to worry about releasing to both platforms. So I think it was a totally native WebView. It was not something you could even access yourself on the web. So it was just basically kind of pre-React Native. That was our solution to having code that you could change out really easily natively, but also on the web. Right. So I think those solutions are great. I generally find that because they are improving their performance, but for a long time it was like you knew that it wasn't native and you're like, why is it all of a sudden slow and crappy? But they are improving that. But yeah, I agree. Other than that, there's really no reason for it.
I was on the programming committee for RailsConf this year.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I did notice just on the I can't believe it's not native subject. It seems like Rails developers are getting a lot more interested in mobile just because we got, I don't remember how many we actually accepted, but we got a lot of proposals that were talking about the pros and cons of mobile web versus a hybrid app versus a pure native app hitting a pure JSON API.
Yeah.
It was a higher number than I've seen in the past in terms of proposals. So
That's awesome.
Interesting. Yeah.
I think the community at large and I think the managers and business folks are definitely kind of getting to a place where it's not economical. And from an engineering perspective, it doesn't make a ton of sense that if you wanted to build an app, I always think about Netflix as an example, the number of platforms that they want to release to, if you had to have one developer for each of those platforms, then each of those developers would have to start from scratch and you wouldn't be able to share any issues or troubles they ran into, especially at a company that large. If the iOS engineer is like, oh, this turned out to be really difficult, the Android engineer would have no way of knowing unless, they did an amazing job at communication. And so I think the web is a really attractive solution to that problem because of it works everywhere, or at least it has historically. I, as a native developer, have issues with this, but I do think there is a problem and it needs to be solved. I think this is just the most available solution right now.
I mean, I kind of like, are you familiar with the approach that Inbox took?
No.
So one of the things that they did, because they have a ton of business logic.
Yeah.
But they're just built on top of the Gmail API.
Oh, they used J to Objective-C, didn't they?
Yeah. And then also another thing that translates it to JavaScript.
Yeah.
And so all of their business logic, all of their non-UI code is written in Java and is fully shared between their apps.
Yeah.
And then all of the UI code is just written in whatever native whatever, which I don't necessarily like the code generation approach because it's too easy to get out of sync.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the listeners will be surprised to hear me pitch Rust for this, but I think a language like Rust, which or any other language that can easily link to other languages, Go actually probably makes a lot of sense in certain contexts as well. But just having the business logic shared in a language that my point being in a language that isn't JavaScript,
right? Yeah,
because my issue with using the web for this, it doesn't even have to have types, but just a little more sane.
Yeah, no, I agree. I imagine that's probably what Apple was thinking when they came out with Swift, that it could be that kind of thing.
In theory, it definitely could. There's no reason you couldn't compile some Swift code and load it from an Android app.
Yep, people have already done it. I think that those solutions are way more attractive to me. I think the problem is that it relies heavily on people, major corporations like Apple and Google, getting on board with some sort of one of these languages and, you know, migrating over.
I don't even know that it's that. I think it just requires somebody in the community for one of these languages, that basically any compiled language that emits a dwarf object that can be loaded from Android easily.
Yeah.
If it can be loaded from Android easily, it can be loaded from
anything.
iOS easily, presumably. But, you know, any compiled language, right? I think it really just requires somebody from one of those communities making an effort to make it easy and ergonomic to do that interaction from every mobile platform.
Yeah.
I don't know that it necessarily requires like a blessing from the ecosystems themselves.
I didn't mean more a blessing. I meant more like, I think the problem is with mobile platforms specifically that what they are providing is an abstraction on top of a language. And so it would be much nicer if that abstraction could be applied to other languages or abstracted maybe like even further so that it could become slightly more language agnostic. Because I think the issue right now, when you were seeing this, or at least I'm seeing this with React Native, is that you have an Android app, which eventually the code is all being compiled down via the JVM to bytecode. But React Native is an abstraction of JavaScript, and Android is an abstraction over just kind of standard Java. And so when you keep adding layers, it gets really complicated, and debugging sometimes can be super impossible. So something has to give and become more flexible, because right now it's all too like tightly coupled with itself and how it wants to work.
Right. The big distinction that I guess I try to make here is I don't want UI code to be cross-platform.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And then business logic, like, it's just calling functions.
Yep.
Right. You don't need the complex.
Right.
It's not even complex. It's more ceremony to load a compiled library from the JVM than it is. I actually have no clue how it is from Swift. Objective-C, it was nothing because it was a C library as far as you were concerned.
Yeah.
Yes, it's hard to debug if something goes wrong, because debugging compiled code, if you're not familiar with it, is hard. And again, I think that one in particular for mobile is just a matter of somebody in the ecosystem taking the time to
make it
to
better.
Solve those problems and make it better.
Yeah. I think the other issue is that like for on mobile apps specifically, it's not... there isn't as clear of a separation between UI and business logic. You know what I mean? Because there's also like the idea of like, is your application running or not? And like, where do we put that kind of stuff? And so I think that's where it gets tricky, and you're still relying on a framework to help you with life cycles and things of that nature.
Well, in a lot of applications, like I think I've talked to you about Cigar Finder in the past. The business logic for that was absurdly simple.
Right.
It was 90% UI code. And I think that a lot of mobile apps fall into that category.
Yeah.
And this isn't even talking about games, which are in their own weird category what the hell even is business or UI.
Right, yeah.
Like, is physics business logic or UI code?
$1 million question. That's interesting. I'm excited that's happening, that more people are getting interested. It's definitely fascinating being a native developer at this time, I feel, because part of me is like, I don't know that native development as it is today will exist in 10 years. I think it's going to be something more hybrid, but I don't want to learn JavaScript. So like, what
I don't
do I
you.
Do? So it's been interesting to try and kind of hedge your bets, but also be honest with about like what I enjoy about programming and what are the minimum requirements for a language that I'd like to learn.
No, I mean, I think that's an interesting, because you know, the only real analogy I think we can draw from historically is native non-mobile apps. I want to say desktop apps because that's the wrong term, but I actually don't know what the right general term is for computers that aren't phones.
Yeah, I don't.
That are either a laptop or a desktop.
Desktop app, I guess. Yeah.
Sure. But, you know, Windows won, but yet it didn't.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not like everybody's writing, well, certainly it can seem like, depending on your circles, that everybody's just writing Electron apps, which is the embed the node in and the web in a native app.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, C#'s incredibly popular. People are writing native OS X apps. And then people are also writing native Linux apps.
Yeah.
They tend to not be so much on the GUI side, or if they are, their GUIs are of very questionable quality most of the time, but they also exist.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to hear that you don't know that, like, I'm assuming when you say you don't know that native mobile won't be around in 10 years, that you think it'll go to like mobile web or some sort of centralized.
Something, yeah. It's too discrete right now, and I think it kind of has to come back together a little bit.
I mean, it's two, though.
Yeah, but...
you know, we're ignoring Windows Phone here, right?
Yeah, I guess, but I think that two is just for mobile, and then I think when you add, again, Netflix is my example, you know, then you would need an Apple TV app, you need a, what is the Amazon one called?
I have no clue.
And then Google has
Fire
one.
Something?
Yeah, the Fire Stick, and then there's the Chrome circle thing that you plug in and dangles from the TV.
I mean, yeah, I think that's more of a problem for everybody but mobile, though.
Yeah.
Mobile's a lot more fundamental. Like, there's a lot more justification for writing a native Android app and a native iOS app for every TV. Like, yeah, TV needs to centralize.
Right.
Definitely, I think most apps should consider if they can just go hybrid web to start.
No, for sure.
Though there's still value in then switching to a native mobile app afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
We used a travel service for like a year and a half called Panna.
Yep, we use Panna.
Okay. So I always felt like a second class citizen with them because my only interaction with them was via email.
Yep.
And they had a native iOS app that seemed really slick that I never got to try.
Yeah.
And then they, shortly after I canceled my account, apparently added a web UI, which looks like it does everything that the iOS app does.
Yep.
But it's just like, that seems like the much more reasonable target for MVP.
Yeah. And I think that React Native is the mobile web just one inch farther, where it is really native. But when you're writing it, you get to write JavaScript, which for, you know, us here at Thoughtbot is awesome because it means that our designers can do what they normally do, which is write UI code and, you know, implement their own designs, which is a problem for us on native because they don't know, you know, native design languages. So that's nice.
I guess I never thought of it from that point of view.
Yeah.
Because I've always heard of like the, and you can share code, your UI code between platforms, which for me is always just like, don't do that though. That's.
Yeah. I don't think it would be a secret to anyone here that I do not care for React Native. I think it's good at what it does, kind of. I don't think it's great at it, but I think it's the first solution out there, really, which I commend Facebook for. I think that's awesome. And it's been fun to try it out. I think it's, again, definitely a solution. It's the first one, and I don't think it's the best possible.
Glowing review. Yeah. It's a solution.
Yeah.
I will openly admit I've never used React Native.
Yeah.
My knowledge of it is roughly just it's React.
Yep.
It compiles to native code.
Yep.
Sounds like it more or less does what's on the tin.
Yep.
And I remember that Shopify went really all in on React Native and then 8 months later completely abandoned it. And I don't know why, other than just everybody who worked on mobile in the company was like, React Native was a huge mistake.
Yeah, it's interesting. The nice thing is, you know, for these MVP apps where you just want to kind of get something out to market, I think it's a very nice option because you can do it quickly. You don't need as many developers and designers. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I think where it stops making sense is when you really want to build out a product, a custom product, to either integrate with other apps or just as your own kind of standalone. And then you do want to be using native things. You know, in React, they have a wrapper around list view, which like, there are things about list view that are like intentionally optimized for memory and scrolling performance and all the stuff. And as much as like you can try to get that right to rebuild it all, you'd be doing just that. You'd be rebuilding it all, which is not necessary. My issue is also with versioning. They're not great at it, at least documenting it. And so if you ever have an issue, Googling it is impossible because people are like, what
do you mean when you mean
you
versioning? You mean like versioning your app or like how they document changes between versions of React Native?
How they document changes of React Native versions. It's very confusing. They break things a lot of the time. As a native developer, I'm not accustomed to having like a whole local Rails or web environment set up on my machine. So for me, if there's a bug, I see it on GitHub. There's changes to some code somewhere and very little of it has to do with my own personal environment. Whereas with React Native, and I imagine with other web projects, a lot of it can be based on just your local environment and like what version of everything you're using. And there's so many dependencies with React Native. It's unbelievable to me. And as a native mobile developer, you're kind of in this mindset of like, I don't really want to use dependencies because it'll grow my app size or, you know.
Are you sure it's not because Maven is terrible?
Yeah, there's that too. But, you know, so you definitely have this like, it becomes not okay to use dependencies. And so when you jump into React Native and people are like, oh, here's 17 dependencies, download them all. And oh, by the way, the versions are going to conflict and it'll take you an hour to figure out which ones it is.
Right.
So I'm just like, no, thank you.
All right, let's take a break for a moment and talk about this week's sponsor, FreshBooks. So you're racing against the clock to wrap up three projects, prepping for a meeting later in the afternoon, all while trying to tackle a mountain of paperwork. Welcome to life as a freelancer. Challenging? Yes. But our friends at FreshBooks believe the rewards are so worth it. The working world has changed. With the growth of the internet, there's never been more opportunities for the self-employed. To meet this need, FreshBooks is excited to announce the launch of an all-new version of their cloud accounting software. It's been redesigned from the ground up and custom-built for exactly the way you work. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quickly. The all-new FreshBooks is not only ridiculously easy to use, it's also packed full of powerful features. Create and send professional-looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. Set up online payments with just a couple of clicks and get paid up to 4 days faster. And you can see when your client has seen your invoice and put an end to the guessing games. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to all of our Bike Shed listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/bike and enter the Bike Shed all uppercase, three separate words, in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Thank you so much to FreshBooks for sponsoring the podcast. So do you think that, I'm trying to remember, what was the name of the thing that was big before React Native that Microsoft ended up buying out?
Oh, something with
the
an
C-sharp
A.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
That one. Whatever that one was called. And now React Native. I mean, there were a few. There were three big ones I remember back in those days.
Yep.
I don't remember the names of any of them, but
no,
they existed.
Yeah.
And one of them got bought by Microsoft, and it's still around, and I just don't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, do you think that if... Because save bookmark to home screen exists. Mm-hmm. Do you think that if Apple and Google allowed you to publish save bookmark to home screen in the app stores, that these would have gotten nearly as big as they did? Because, you know, you can just... There's save bookmark to home screen. Like, you go to a webpage, and the webpage, like... is for all intents and purposes a native app, other than push notifications are a thing for the web now.
Yeah,
but even ignoring that, right? It was basically just couldn't interact with various system UIs or system APIs, but like for things that were pull only.
Yeah,
it's a native app, right? And they're save bookmark to home screen, but it's always felt like a second class citizen.
Yeah,
but what if you could just have your web app and then put it on Play Store or the App Store? But it was literally just save bookmark to home screen. But your user didn't feel like it was a second class citizen that way. Do you think then that React Native and app whatever would have gotten nearly as big if that were an option?
I mean, for Android, it basically already is for any web app.
Is it?
Yeah, you can save anything to the home screen.
Well, no, I know, but the point being, right, that I think a lot of people went to a native app, even if that native app was literally, because there also used to be the pattern before, I think Google banned it even, didn't they, where your app was literally just a web view?
Oh, I didn't realize, I don't know if they banned it.
That used to be a big thing, like, whenever iOS 4 was, and I was still working in marketing, I remember that was a big thing, and I feel like I recall hearing of Google just, like, actually banning it, and Apple as well, of, like, if your app is literally just a web view, you can't do that anymore. Yeah. I remember a lot of people did that, because even though save bookmark to home screen was a thing, users didn't know it was a thing.
Right.
And it's also just not, where, like, if you wanted Twitter, I mean, Twitter probably needs a native app, just because push notifications and tighter integration there, but ignoring that, right?
Yeah.
If it was literally just, I wanted to browse my tweets, there's absolutely no reason Twitter needs a native app.
No, yeah, I agree. I don't know why native became the like de facto way for companies to get like their products on people's phone. I think there's a lot of examples of apps that don't need to exist. I think in the like female world of things, there are all these apps that are basically just calendars. They help you book appointments with a service. And like to download your app to book an appointment, that's like insanely annoying to me, because then also I don't get Chrome autofill. So I don't get like any of the features that I'd like if you just left it as a website. So I think there was this like companies believe like, oh, we need an app. So on our ad or on our marketing, whatever, we can say we have an app. And I think that it had much less to do with the actual user experience and a lot more to do with being able to include a link to the Play Store and the App Store on their marketing sites.
You forgot the part where you go to their mobile webpage, which actually has more functionality than their native app, but like it's impossible to use because every time you do anything, the huge pop-up blocks your entire screen saying, open this page in our native app.
Yep. I actually think GitHub does it the best in terms of like, here's our mobile app, but if you want to use the desktop one, here's a very easy like link to click it.
Yep. And then when you're on the desktop one, it has that semi non-intrusive, like obvious, easy to find, easy to click when you're done with your mobile website doesn't do this thing that I need, but I need this thing right now. Yep. You know, it takes up like, probably an eighth of your screen, the go back to mobile version. Because their mobile version is great for the like 65% of their functionality that it covers.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Yeah.
Having said that, I have tweeted in the past about a native GitHub app, so I feel I should just clarify. I think that if I could review a pull request, if there was an app that was just designed for that, that would be awesome. Because that's really hard to do on mobile right now on GitHub.
Sure.
But that's my only, that's the only thing I would want the app to do.
I agree, only because I just remember leaving comments that were like, I'm on mobile, but line X of this file is wrong.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I agree. I don't know why. I mean, I'm happy people did. That's why I have a job. But I don't know why. It seems very silly to me.
Have you heard that you can like pre-register for apps on the Play Store now? What do you think of that?
I haven't heard that.
So like you've heard of Super Mario Run, right?
Yes.
So I don't know of any apps that are doing this other than the two Nintendo apps. Mm-hmm. But because they also announced Fire Emblem for mobile.
Okay.
And back in, I think it was January, they both showed up on the Play Store with this magic link that was like pre-register. And it was literally just send me a push notification when this app is available.
Oh, I have seen that for other apps.
I mean, I assumed it was for other apps as well.
Yeah,
but
no, I've seen that for other apps.
I remember Super Mario Run was just one of the bigger ones because like Nintendo completely shit on Android as a platform during their during their latest keynote thingy. But then shockingly a month later, we're coming to Android very, very soon.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think stuff like that's awesome. I've always kind of felt things like on iTunes, you can pre-order a movie or pre-order an album before it's released, which I think has always been so silly because the reason you used to pre-order in the real physical world was because supply was limited.
Right.
But if it's a digital content, what are we talking about? Why would I pre-order a movie and you're only pre-ordering it so you get a push notification?
Well, and then this is becoming a big thing in the gaming world because now game developers are like, and if you pre-order our game, we give you this powerful item for pre-ordering.
Yeah, it's like, it's very silly. But I do think, like, as a user, I downloaded I'm really into Top Chef, and so I bought the entire season on iTunes. And I will say it's very nice because I have no idea when it airs. I have absolutely no idea, and I'm sure I could find out some way or set up some calendar event, whatever. But iTunes sends me an email every time there's an episode available, and that is worth the $30 for the season's pass in my mind. I get to watch it without commercials, and I get notified when there's a new episode. That's all I need.
I mean, they could also just offer that functionality without charging money, though.
They could, but they're very smart, and they don't. So
right, fair enough.
But I think that people like getting notifications about and like pre-ordering and...
Oh, yeah. No, my favorite app, by the way... Space fans out there. So my only real hobby is space.
Okay. Like, did you see NASA's announcement today?
I saw that they delayed the birthing of the dragon, but I'm guessing that's not what you're referring
to. That is not what I'm referring to. NASA had a massive press conference today. They announced that they have identified 7 Earth-like planets orbiting a nearby star.
Wait, how near?
It's still 400 light years away. So, or 40.
That's
no, 40.
Better than...
Yeah, 40 is pretty close. But there was a live press conference today. It was really... like kind of really fascinating, but 7 planets is huge and Earth-like, which is very exciting.
Yeah, no, that is very huge.
Yeah,
I have not seen that.
We can link to the Google or the YouTube video of the announcement in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah, we'll link to that. I'm gonna stop reading this now because that's gonna occupy all of my time for an hour after we end this. But no, like I'm very interested in more of the like physics and mechanics of orbiting Earth and.
Yep.
Traveling within our solar system and that sort of thing. It's a weird hobby, but it's a thing I'm very, very into. So I especially like watching real rockets launch and like having the actual telemetry and then like graphing it and being like, yay, those numbers match up. So I have an app. It's called Space Flight Now. Space fans, Space Flight Now. It's on the Play Store. It's great.
Oh, nice.
It literally, all it does just whenever a rocket's launching, sends me a push notification. It's like, here's where you can watch a live stream.
Perfect.
And I have developed very strong opinions about which countries have the best live streams of their rocket launches, which I would not have even known that these various countries did these live streams except for this app.
Yeah. The Skim, which is a daily newsletter, I think it was founded with the idea of, you know, for women, by women. They have an iOS app. And at first I was like, why? It started out just an email that you got in your inbox every morning. And it was like, here's what's happening in the world today. And you can read this all on the toilet. Like, it was not complicated. It wasn't like whole newspaper, because that obviously exists. It was like, here's a very simple email. And then they released an app. And I remember thinking, this, what, why? Why do I need this? I'm not going to open the app. You already sent me an email. But what they do is basically just link to your calendar, and they put all the like world events in the calendar for you. Everything from like the Oscars to elections to the last day to register for the New York City Marathon. I think it might be location, that one is particularly location based, but all the calendar events have information and links to like more information about it. They're all emojis, so your calendar looks really cool, but totally stupid, but absolutely worth downloading, because I now like, you know, for other random events that you not might not pay attention to, but the whole world like comes to the office and like, hey, the Oscars were this week. And I'm like, I knew that. I knew that was coming.
I think my favorite push notification only app, it actually did more stuff than push notifications, I think, but I only know it for push notifications, was the What to Expect app, which just every week sends a push notification. Your baby is the size of this fruit.
Oh, my God.
Every week. It was like, our baby's now the size of a spaghetti squash.
Did you find, so there was a New York Times article, this is going to possibly get a little dark, but there was a New York Times article, I think a few months ago, about someone who had downloaded that app and then unfortunately suffered a miscarriage. But because when you sign up for that app, I guess you also get marketing materials and you'll get other stuff in the mail. And so like while she had like notified the app of her situation, the rest of the world and like where they were sending her information had not been notified. So like when the due date came around, like she got a gift package and like this weird stuff. And it was all about like how to handle having a baby on the internet that you didn't really have. And I imagine that that's something that's not yet been figured out.
No, I mean, the internet thought we were pregnant about 2 years before we were actually pregnant. When we first started talking about getting pregnant and we looked up diapers or something on Amazon. And then when you look up something on Amazon,
it's forever.
That gets leaked to literally everything.
Yep.
And so we've been getting baby stuff for years, but not the terrible miscarriage story, because that's very sad.
Yeah.
But the talking about marketing and babies thing, since you do Android, I have a very funny story from yesterday.
Okay.
So a person who works at Google, because I send out my tweet like, Ruby wants onesies, send Ruby onesies. And so people have been sending me various onesies.
Oh, that's very sweet.
We got a onesie from Google. By the way, if you're listening, it's cool. Don't worry about it. I just think it's funny. Apparently, the company they use for their onesies like sends everything via UPS.
Uh-huh.
UPS charges a fee to take things across the border for you.
I see.
So it comes, and Tessa's like, "Hey, did you order anything that's cash on delivery?" No. What is it?
You can't know.
And I'm looking at it, it's $20. I'm like, oh, that's probably like customs fees or something. And Tess had to get her phone replaced or something. So I thought maybe it was related to that or something.
Yeah.
It was like the label is like X marketing department from Pennsylvania or something, you know, nothing identifiable. Anyway, so we sign for it. We pay the $20, whatever, it comes in. I'm like, this box is awfully light. I open it. It's the Google onesie.
Amazing.
The customs fees for it were $2.
Amazing.
And then UPS charged $18 to take it across the border for you and then also charged tax on that.
Jesus. And I'm sure the cost of the onesie did not justify that.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm sure the onesie was like, what, $4?
Yeah.
You know, maybe
but
a little
bit. But she has it.
She has it. No, it's a very nice onesie. Yeah. I'm glad we have it.
Yeah.
I just think it's funny.
That is really funny. I didn't even think about that.
I mean, certainly the person who sent it like did not intend for that to happen.
Right, yeah.
But just like,
it's the gift that keeps on giving and taking a little.
Oh, yeah. No, it's actually great because Google has become my favorite company from a baby point of view, because everybody has like a lot of companies have onesies as swag. They have 6-month-old onesies.
Is that what size is normal?
6 month, I guess, is normal. Babies exist for more than I guess that's probably they do that because that's the age where it's like companies think to send a swag package.
Right.
But so I remember this person was like, hey, I hear you want onesies. Would you like a Google onesie? I'm like, yeah. And then their next question was, oh, cool. So we have these colors and sizes. And the sizes range from newborn to 2 years.
Amazing.
I'm like, you're the only person who has a size other than 6 months. Because we have so many 6-month onesies.
Yep.
By the way, listeners, if you were thinking of sending more onesies and it's only 6 months, don't let this discourage you. When she's 6 months old, I will tweet pictures of my baby in your onesie.
Yep. I've always thought it was interesting about baby sizing that it's all based on age, because like some babies are larger and smaller. I guess that like it's the more politically correct way to describe your baby, because if you had to just be like, how many inches is your baby? People might get offended. Or
it's not even that. You don't really measure your baby in inches. Like age is the only measurement that you're likely to have.
Yeah.
And babies actually are roughly similar size. And it's not like when I say 6 month, it's not actually a 6 month
right.
onesie. It's a 3 to 6 month onesie.
Got it. Okay. That's interesting.
You put your baby in, whatever they fit in. Like, but yeah, you switch to the next size up because they stop fitting in the previous size. But they will almost certainly be born at newborn sized onesie or smaller.
That's so crazy. Humans.
Yeah. Tiny humans are interesting.
Yeah. Are you enjoying it? It being a father, not it being your daughter.
It's fine. It's honestly like right now she eats and then she goes to sleep.
Yep.
And then she poops.
It's a dream.
Oh, yeah. You know, I figure it'll be a lot more of a thing in like 6 months to a year.
Yeah.
When she starts to get a little closer to talking and like she doesn't even smile yet.
Oh, yeah.
Especially because she was born 6 months premature. So like her muscles were all really underdeveloped.
Got
so.
It.
She was actually only supposed to be born 6 days ago.
Oh, wow.
So her gestational age is 1 week, like 1 week old.
Got it. So there's more time.
41 weeks old, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's been a thing. I am glad, like, I always feel a little bit disappointed because occasionally I'll go, you know, I'll go look at, like, somebody's like, oh, we're hiring. And I'll just go read the job post because I'm, like, curious what that company is like. And they'll be like, oh, and we have a really, really great maternity leave package. Like, we offer 2 or 3 months of full pay. And it's like, that's really progressive in the U.S.
Yep.
And it's like, and we offer 2 weeks for dad.
Yeah, it's just not the same.
I haven't been the greatest at, like, everything with baby stuff, especially just because some stuff with Diesel kind of jumped out at me from nowhere.
Uh-huh.
But, like, I still couldn't imagine. My wife and I sleep in shifts right now.
Yeah.
And I could not imagine her, like, me actually just being full-time back at work.
Right. Yeah, it's insane.
And it's been 6 weeks.
Yeah.
A number of weeks that are well beyond actually most companies' maternity leave policy in the United States, much less paternity leave.
I think the problem with maternity leave is that I think it originated as a medical leave, which is why the time period was so short. It was like if you were going to go out and have surgery, it was the same, like, in the paperwork form and what column they filled in. It was just a medical leave, which is why parental leave was never a thing for so long. And then the rest of the world was like, that's not how babies work. It's not just a medical issue, like, especially parents who adopt or use surrogates. Like,
right.
I am just as, you know, they are just as much a parent as anybody else. And so we're definitely not there yet. But
well, that's why, especially just like, not to go too far down this road, but when people raise, like, oh, we don't want to hire X because hey, if they just get hired and then have a child, like, that's a less useful employee to us. It's just like, I'm sorry that the biological imperative of the human race is inconvenient to you. But hey, people need to reproduce and we need to make sure our babies don't die.
Yep.
So maybe don't be a dick about it.
That should be your policy.
Yeah.
I would love to see a company describe it that way. We foster and encourage your biological imperative to reproduce. Applications welcome.
It's just like, it shouldn't be like on the government to provide unemployment insurance to cover parental leave, especially because just that's always going to cover, at least in tech, that's always going to cover significantly less than your actual salary and therefore likely cost of living it approximates.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, it's just sad to me that, like, we can't just rely on companies to be decent human beings when it comes to letting people take a reasonable amount of time off to adjust to their new life as a parent and make sure that their child is okay before putting it in a daycare of questionable quality every day.
No, it's terrifying.
RailsConf has daycare, though. I'm sure that'll be great.
Ooh, that's awesome. That's definitely one of those things when I first got started, I remember I went to a Write Speak Code conference, or the conference is called Write Speak Code, and it was something that they like promoted very early on. And I remember that was my first conference I ever attended, and I was like, I was, you know, a kid, so like I hadn't even thought about, I don't have kids, I was myself a child. I was like, oh, daycare is for me, but I hadn't even thought about that kind of, what would you do, especially when conferences go over on the weekends? It's like maybe you have like, you know, daycare Monday through Friday, but if a conference rolls onto a Saturday. I mean,
Well, and you almost certainly don't have daycare in the town that you don't live in.
Right. That's the other thing. Yeah.
I don't know if they're doing it this year, but I remember they were talking about doing last year was also providing daycare in the evenings.
Oh.
That's the other thing is that if you're just going to a conference, you can probably, if you really needed to, you could find a daycare for the day, like during the conference. But then there's also
a party at night or something.
The events that happen in the evenings where like Like, I'm actually probably going to have just the baby in a Bjorn, because I'm emceeing my track, and she's going to have a little train conductor outfit.
Amazing.
And then I got the t-shirt design for the conference. I'm getting a onesie made.
Amazing.
You know, I got a baby called Ruby. We're going to RailsConf. She's going to go be the celebrity Ruby baby.
That's amazing.
So she'll probably just be in a Bjorn the majority of the conference.
That's hilarious.
To be perfectly honest. But, like, I'm not wearing my baby in a Bjorn at a bar.
No. That's not advised.
So I hope they actually do that. If not, I know somebody offered to watch her at least one night. My mom's actually talking about flying to the conference watching the baby for us. Because it's in Phoenix. We're from Albuquerque.
Close enough, yeah.
So it's an hour flight.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to see pictures of that.
So what do you think? Should we wrap up?
Yeah.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/101.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are greatly appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any other episode, you can email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm. You can tweet us @_bikeshed, or you can leave a comment on the show notes.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time on Bike Shed.